You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino.
That's right. ChumbaCasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes.
ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
I wanna be a producer with a hit show on Broadway. I wanna be a producer.
Hi, I'm Andrew Child, and welcome to 50 Key Stage Musicals, the podcast, a companion piece to the Routledge Press publication 50 Key Stage Musicals, which is available for purchase by going to Routledge.com or clicking the link below in today's show description. Today's episode focuses on Chapter 41, The Producers, and with us today is author of that chapter, Casey R.T. Graham. Casey is a director, music director, writer, and educator. Associate and resident director credits include the Broadway revival of On the 20th Century, the national tour of The Phantom of the Opera, and the U.S. and Australian tours of Dirty Dancing. Conducting credits include the national tours of Oklahoma, The Producers, The Wizard of Oz, and Spring Awakening. Casey is head of the musical theater department at the University of Nevada, Reno. His book, Small Talk, is available on Amazon. Casey, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
So just to kick things off, can you tell us a little bit about what is your relationship with the musical, The Producers?
Yeah, I conducted the first non-equity tour. So it was 2005, the first non-equity tour of The Producers to go out. And I didn't know anything about the show beforehand.
Okay.
I grew up on the West Coast, so I was not quite as in touch with musical theater on Broadway and in New York as a lot of people were. Mm. It was, you know, kind of before the days of chat rooms really taking off. So like the Broadway news didn't circulate quite as heavily. So I was familiar with it from the Tony Awards and kind of word of mouth, but hadn't seen or really heard much about it until I was hired to conduct the tour.
Okay, wow. And what were your original impulses when you were interacting with this material?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, like, obviously it is wildly funny. And then you sort of get past that, and there's like an immense amount of heart to it, which is what really surprised me. It like sneaks up on you because it's so over the top and so ribald that then to have kind of this, it's a love story really between Max and Leo at the end. And so it really like hits you in a different way that you're not expecting so late in the show. So once I was hired to do the tour, they took me to New York to see the show a couple times, so like get a feel for it and how it flows. And my first thought was like, it was so wildly funny. And like, I didn't know how it was going to play across the rest of America. Because on a non-equity tour, you're not playing the major cities. So you can have expected to play similarly in Boston or LA or Chicago. But when you get into like tiny towns like Waco, Texas or Paducah, mm-hmm. Kentucky, like how is it going to play in smaller towns when the humor is so broad? It sort of mocks everyone and anyone under the sun. It's so non-politically correct. Like, how is all this stuff going to play in smaller towns? I remember they get to the number, Keep It Gay. And I was like, I don't know what this is going to do in small town America. And it was one of the biggest surprises of my career because it played wildly successfully in these small towns who just like ate up every moment of it, laughed along with you. I was afraid there'd be a little bit of laughing at because it's such big characters, mm-hmm. but just like laughing with the show, which was such a nice experience.
Was that, do you think, sort of a nervousness that was shared by the company, by the whole production team when the tour was starting?
I think a little. I think especially the cast was you know, it is a comedy you have to throw yourself into or it doesn't work. And so I think that, you know, until you get that first couple test audiences on the road, you're not sure. And when you do a show in the same city, you're going to have generally the same audience feel. But when you're taking it to all these different markets, north, south, east, west, you're just not quite sure what to expect. And it sort of was universally just adored all over the country, all over Canada, everywhere we played. Just wow. People ate it up.
Which this is not a show that is that's necessarily a given. You know, you've got Keep It Gay. You've got Springtime for Hitler, you know.
Yeah. You've got that entire sequence. You've got, I mean, misogyny all over the place. You've got in Ula, and like, how are people going to take it? And it's one of the brilliant things about the show, I think, is the way it's structured. Like, you get to Keep It Gay, and you're like, okay, well, anybody in the audience who's maybe even slightly homophobic is like gonna leave by now. But then you introduce Ula, so they're like, well, maybe I'll stay, because like, there's obviously like sex symbols in the show as well. For me, there's just like something for everyone. I think it's one of the like little Easter eggs of the show is how it's structured to like just keep offending you, but then bringing you back in the next scene.
There we go. That can be the something for everyone in the producers and something to offend everyone too. Just, you know, kind of balance out the scale. Did you come across anything in researching for this chapter that you felt like content wise sort of paved the way for this show to become such a runaway Broadway hit?
Yeah, I think part of it was the timing. You know, we hadn't at like 2000, 2001 in New York, it was a very serious time. Like we had family shows and we had serious shows. We had like the hangovers of Phantom and Les Mis that sort of like played out for the next decade. And so we didn't really have like shows that were just written to go and laugh and to go and have fun. And so I think that part of it is really what like set it up to be successful, is people were hungry for something like that.
Okay.
The other nugget that research that I must have known at some point in the back of my head was I hadn't realized or remembered that Mel Brooks was a World War II combat veteran. You know, you can say, you know, he's Jewish, he's allowed to make these jokes about the Holocaust, but he like really is allowed to sort of make these jokes. He was there on the front lines. Like, this is in his DNA and in his history. It comes from obviously a long line of Jewish comedians poking fun at themselves and poking fun at their adversaries. But like, he lived this experience, which I don't know that I had appreciated when I was doing the show.
That does, it certainly gives so much context. I remember really not loving, maybe controversial opinion, the movie Jojo Rabbit, just because I felt like it wasn't harsh enough about Hitler. It didn't hit hard enough. And I think the gold standard, if you're going to make a Hitler joke, it is Springtime for Hitler. It is so vicious. It has such a bite to it. But it's also so iconic and over the top, and obviously stands on the shoulders with such a respect for musical theater history that he also has. So I do think that is something that gives us context, that he was actually in the field, he was actually on the ground, and that certainly we can imagine colors Springtime for Hitler.
Sorry, go ahead.
Go for it.
No, I love the two layers of Springtime for Hitler, the layer of Mel Brooks writing it and it's just so funny and so wrong. But then the layer of Roger Debris directing the show and like his take to it and like how over the top that character takes it, thinking he's making something high art. Like, I just love watching it through both of those lenses.
I'm curious, you know, because so many people say about so many different movies, so many different shows, you know, oh, they couldn't get away with that today. Yeah. Do you think, is the producers something that we will continue to produce, continue to see produced, and continue to enjoy?
Yeah, I've gone back and forth on where it like will fall as far as that in history and being revived and being reproduced. It is produced still a lot around the country. So I think that question is answered as yes, it will continue to be produced. I don't know like what a revival of the producers looks like, if there's tweaks at all. You know, it's one of those, it's such an equal opportunity offender that I don't know. If you take one thing out, it's going to make one group happy. But if you take something out, it's going to make another group unhappy. And there are obviously some negative stereotypes of various folk in the show. And I don't know. I haven't answered that for myself, and it's not, I don't really have to, which is nice, but yeah, I don't know what that next, I think the person who directs the first Broadway revival of it has a challenge on their hands as to whether or not you're going to do it kind of museum style, like Chorus Line is always generally done, or if you're going to take it in a whole new direction and find something new to tell about it, or find new ways to find humor in it without necessarily causing harm to minority groups.
Well, and it's such an interesting conundrum, because I feel like the producers, when we talk about a revival, Susan Stroman and Mel Brooks working together, firing at 100%, have it such down to a science, to a point where, if listeners are interested, in the interview I do about Hello Dolly, Leroy Reams talks about going in as a replacement for Roger Debris and sort of presenting this idea. He thought it would be funny if he didn't shave his legs for the role, and how that becomes this whole conversation. And, you know, you need Mel Brooks's approval, because everything is that much of a science with all of these jokes and the pacing and everything.
Yeah, it's one of those shows that when you license it, you get the option to like do the original choreography, and it comes telling you exactly how it goes, because it is so, like, from the jokes, the choreography, it is such a specific machine that a lot of the jokes don't play if you don't do the original choreography. You know, they don't have the same impact. It's one of those shows where like every aspect of the show is in on the joke. So if you change it up a little bit, the joke becomes something different.
Do you think was working on the producers similar or different from the other national tours that you were working on?
It's a little, it's different. It's very specific, but also comedy is specific to the actors. So they did give the director of the tour, who was the associate of the London production, they gave them license, you know, to play with the actors in the beats and find things that really work for them. You found that in places where you tried to force people to do something that Nathan Lane makes funny, they may not be able to make funny in the same sort of way. Okay. And so you might have to play with it a little bit differently. When you're doing a show that's not quite as broadly comic, I found that, you know, replacements and new casts fit into the mold of it a little bit better, because, you know, they bring themselves to it in a way that reads naturally without really changing the rhythm of the show. Whereas comedy can really change things up and can really alter the like pacing and the rhythm of the piece.
Okay. So, and you can probably speak a little bit more about working with replacements and stand-ins. You've worked as an associate director and resident director as well.
Yes.
Yeah,
that's a big part of the job.
Could you tell us a little bit about like your work on the 20th Century, for instance?
Oh yeah, we had a lot of like random things happen on 20th Century. It was a very short run, but we had a lot of, well, we had a very serious illness in preview. So we had to cancel a preview one night because Peter Gallagher had, at the time, didn't know what it was, but it ended up just being like a viral infection that just needed antibiotics, but we didn't know exactly what it was. So half an hour before curtain, you know, canceled the show, had to put the understudy on, and it's preview, so you haven't had any time to rehearse understudies yet. Mm-hmm. So spent that night in the theater with the cast and Kristen Chenoweth, with like frantically flying through. The associate choreographer and I put him into the show. That taught a lot about putting people in high pressure situations. And he had obviously like done work in advance, so it wasn't starting from scratch, but figuring out, you know, you have 2.5 hours to put someone into a 2.5 hour show. So how do you triage? What are you going to do tonight? What are you going to do tomorrow at 45 minutes before curtain? Because there are also union rules. So you can't call them in like 4 hours early and work on the set. So, you know, you got to be like organized in that moment. It was the most like West Wing experience I've ever had, like walking through the theater with the creative staff and like, are we going to cancel tonight? Like, what's going to happen? The director and choreographer were at another function, so like they weren't available. So we just had to like make all these random decisions. And Kristen Chenoweth was lovely and like stayed the whole night to help them, because it was her scene partner for the whole show. So like, you want to make sure that you're going to be on the same page tomorrow when you get
of
to
course.
That. But yeah, what was the rest of the question about putting people into the shows?
Yeah, I'm just curious for listeners who are maybe interested in what is that like? Would you have any tricks or tools of the trade that you think make that process easier?
Yeah, it's if you are an actor, you want to, I always think you want to approach the understudy role bringing yourself to it, but also realizing that you're fitting into a production. So you have some understudies who come in and want to make like wild changes to the role and change the sexual orientation of the character or make like large things that you just can't do because that upsets the balance of the piece. And it's not the way that the production has been structured. So you want to work with your director and your associate director to find like how you can make the role your own while still kind of coloring inside the lines, if that makes sense. So you're going to bring your own shade to the role, but you can't all of a sudden decide to cross downstage left if there's no lighting downstage left. Like they're not going to follow you. They're not going to redesign the show for each understudy who's on. And it also varies greatly by who the creative team is. Some creative teams kind of want everyone to be exactly, you know, like come in at the same time, do this the same way. Everything's a little bit more cut and dry. And other creative teams are like, no, you're a living, breathing person. Do what like you do, work with your understudies, work with your associate or resident director, find your way into the role. I know on the Phantom tour, we were very loose with understudies. They were like blocking was not, and it came from a British team. So I think that might have something to do with it, but it wasn't as rigid as a lot of shows I've worked on. We had no number line. They had like, they were all in spots. So you could kind of vary up your blocking a little bit within reason. So all of those understudy performances were very different, which I think can be really fun for kind of groupies. You get groupies at shows who want to come see like everyone has ever played the role of Christine Daae. So they'll come and see like what different things that person brought to the role, which can be really fun.
The Phantom of the Opera episode, I got to chat with Susan Russell, who was a replacement in the Broadway production in the role of Carlotta, and she has a lot to say about going in as a replacement, what that's like, and also I believe she started as an understudy in the role, so that was a super interesting conversation. I'd love to, coming back to the producers a little bit, what is it like when you're preparing to conduct a show with this huge, big Broadway sound that's clearly, you know, inspired by, influenced by, a century of these huge shows, what does it look like? What's going through your mind as you're preparing to conduct a national tour of with this score?
Yeah, it's a lot of pre-preparation. So like looking at the score, looking at the instrumentation and figuring out like, why is this one section super brass heavy or who's like the most important voice here? Because you have like a sound engineer, but a lot of a conductor's job is to balance amongst the orchestra itself a little bit, because you can only do so much at the board. So you want to give them something good to start with. So figuring out like, who's your solo? What are they saying with this particular instrumentation? There's like a gorgeous alto, I think it was alto flute, solo in Till Hymn, if that's the name of the song, right? Yeah, end of the show, Till Hymn, that's beautiful and that you like rarely get to hear. And like, you sort of do a little bit of creative problem solving and questioning of like, why did you pick this particular instrument here? And personally, I just think it's because it has a lower, like sweeter, you don't notice it quite as much as if you were to have a flute solo there. And so it like sneaks up on you a little bit. And for me, it sneaks up on you in the same way that the emotion of the song sneaks up on you, that you don't realize like this whole show has been about these two, like, actually forming a legitimate friendship that neither of them has really had the skills to do before. By the end, that it's not a love story. I mean, Ula and Leo have like kind of a superficial, not two-dimensional, but it's more surface level love story. But the real heart of the show is between these two. And you find moments like that are echoed in the orchestration. Also looking at the vocal breakdowns and how things are scored that way. Producers has a lot of offstage singing that they originally record to happen backstage while things are happening. So Springtime for Hitler, you know, you've got most of your ensemble on stage, but then you've got this like heavenly chorus backstage. And so deciding like, how do we get that sound out of the singers? Because some of it is, you know, from the soundboard, but a lot of it is in how the singers approach it. And is it's going for kind of an old school MGM sort of sound here on the Springtime for Hitler, and all that background stuff. And so kind of knowing what's being referenced or figuring out what's being referenced is half the job.
And do you specifically remember anything that you felt like you were really digging into? Like you mentioned MGM sounds. Was there anything else that you feel like is directly and strongly referenced in this score?
Off the top of my head, I don't know any specifics. I do know that the like Judy at the Palace moment is kind of a famous nod to Judy Garland sitting on the edge of the stage. So they brought Roger Debris down as Adolf Hitler to have his Judy Garland moment at the edge of the stage. So as if he weren't camp enough, he's going even a step further. So that's like an allusion reference. They always call it that Judy at the Palace moment where he comes down, he sits in a really like stark spotlight down there, like her concerts at the Palace in New York. There's also the high lows section, which is sort of old school 1940s sound of tight harmony. It's in Springtime for Hitler. And it's the, what is the lyric? the Führer is causing a Führer. It's like the four tappers, and it's like really tight harmony. So that's a fun thing to teach and to work on, and to try to get that specific sound that harkens back to, it's kind of Mannheim Steamroller today, or Manhattan Transfer, that sort of tight harmony that we don't hear as much, but we get to get a little tip of the hat in this number.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on S.E. Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com.
So do you think, is there a different process when you're taking on this show as opposed to when you're taking on conducting a more traditional show like Oklahoma?
Yeah, it can be. I would say, I mean, obviously all musicals are like, the music is steeped in the character and what's happening. But with a show like this that is so heavily parody and satire a bit, that there are going to be other things that they are going to be parodizing, if that's the right word, parodizing. Anyway, gently sending up. So you find those moments like the Judy of the Palace or the High Lows, or Ula's number, which sort of just harkens back to a vamp number of like the 30s, 40s, where you just get two guys who just get to sit there and watch this bombshell sing this like great song. So it's a little bit more, I think, research as far as history in a show. Like if you're doing a show like Oklahoma, you're not necessarily researching the style of music they're singing as much. You're digging more into the character and why is the character singing in this register maybe, or why is the character have this particular song at this moment, so that you can help in coaching the singer and how, where it comes as far as that goes. So I would say for producers, it's more researching the time period, the variation in styles, because you have a lot of different musical styles. There's some like conga sections. There's the sections that want to sound like old German folk songs that Franz gets to sing. So lots of different, you have your sound of like the show, and then you've got all sorts of different pastiche sounds that come in throughout.
Okay. And then how would you say that is even different from conducting a more contemporary show like Spring Awakening?
How's it different? Stylistically, it's very different. It's a show that is intended to sound not super amplified, so that's its own challenge. Whereas Spring Awakening is like, this is a rock concert. We want to blow the audience out of their seats at times. Okay. So approaching it that way, I mean, Spring Awakening to me, I would approach in a much more similar fashion to how I would approach Oklahoma. Like the songs are more storytelling than necessarily producers don't really dig into the characters as much. They're more on the surface. Okay. But Spring Awakening has its own issue because the songs are like a different style than the rest of the show. And so you really dig into like the lyrics are very poetic and do not mean what they mean on the surface. And some of them I'm still convinced don't really mean anything, like they're poetic. But you have to like find something that they mean to you to like talk to the actors about, because they have to be personal to the actors. And the songs are intended to be, Spring Awakening is a little unique because the songs are intended to be the like actor's emotions as if they were experiencing it as the character. So it's a little bit removed from the character. So it's kind of why it's more contemporary than the text is.
Okay.
So that's a whole nother layer of talking to actors and coaching and working with actors. And sometimes that is a music director's job. I've worked on shows as a music director where it was like definitely teamwork in working with the director and talking, coaching actors through songs. And sometimes it's not that. It's more that that's the director's job and you take more of the like technical backseat a little bit. It just kind of depends on the project. Phantom was very much like a Venn diagram of like whose job was what, because it's all sung through. So like the conductor has very strong opinions on how you sing this and what you're meaning, but what your voice is telling the audience in this particular moment. So there's much more overlap between director and music director.
Mm. And you would say that's not as present with something like The Producers?
I think it would be not as present if it was something that had to do with like a joke isn't landing because we can't understand this word or because the song is too fast right now. That would be where you might like chime in a little bit more. But in Producers, it's more about getting the sound you want out of the singer and less about the meaning, I think. It's not always that cut and dry, but I would say that it falls more into that category.
Okay. So this chapter on The Producers, this comes pretty late in the book, you know, where chapter 41 out of 50, do we see and can we already trace the influence of The Producers on later musical theater works?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think Producers sort of gave permission to be a little bit more adult, a little bit naughtier, a little bit more satirical. I think you see it in Book of Mormon and Something Rotten, and you see it in these kind of more broad comedy shows. For sure. And it also was for me, and it's a template that I don't think a lot of people have observed. For me, it was a template on how to make a movie work as a musical. And part of it is, it falls into two categories. One, I think the best movie adaptations into musicals are not your blockbusters. They're shows that were a little more cult, a little more like had a very rabid, loyal following, but it wasn't like the show that everybody could quote and knew everything about. Because you look at something like Young Frankenstein, which same team, wasn't as successful. And I think it's because the movie is much more well-known. You have to include like every little joke that the audience loves and is coming to expect. Producers, they had license to just change so much about it that they could really make it work on stage.
Do you have other movies in mind, like The Producers, that were kind of cult classics or had a smaller following, but they became successful musicals?
Yeah, I mean, I think Once is a good example. You know, it captured a like an art market, but it wasn't, you know, your audience that came to see Once the musical was a broader audience that went to see Once the movie. I think Hairspray is a great example because it's a great movie, but it is weird and it is nothing like the tone of the musical is vastly different. So they were able to just make it a musical that was its own thing. I think those two are like standout examples.
Yeah, I think John Waters, who obviously directed the movie Hairspray, has a joke where he says, yeah, next they're going to do Polyester on Ice. Just because the musical is unrecognizable, has a totally different audience following. Yeah. It's totally different. And kind of, I guess, like The Producers in a way, went from a movie to a musical. And then that musical was then made into another movie.
Yeah, yeah. And there's other shows like, you look at a show like Big, that the movie was wildly successful. And there's so many points of that movie that people remember that you have to recreate, that then it just becomes about coming to the theater to like see that moment. Right. Whereas when you pick musicals or movies that are less popular, the audience expectation is just different.
Right. I feel like Waitress is another good example of that, because I know people who have gone to see the musical, open the program and said, this is based on a movie. You know, it's got a smaller following.
And I think time, that might be the second thing I was going to say. I think time is also a factor. You know, the musical came so much after the movie. Same thing with Waitress. It was 15 years or more, around 10, 15 years. When you make it, you know, after the big hit, people are expecting, that's very fresh in their mind. They're expecting that, especially back in the days when we didn't have Netflix. You know, if you saw a movie and then 2 years later it was on stage, you're going to have very vivid memories about what that movie is going to look like and sound like. And you're dealing with performances. You have to feel like, do you recreate? Do you tip your hat? How do you approach that aspect?
Do you think that the success of The Producers, because it was wildly successful, it broke records with its ticket sales, with the Tony Awards it won, it was a hard ticket to come by. Do you think that the success of The Producers sort of inspired an influx of movies to musical adaptations?
Oh, yes, I absolutely. You see, I mean, after it, in its wake, you see a lot. I think the next like 3 or 4 Tony winners for Best Musical were based on movies. Still to this day, I mean, we have so many films adapted. I do think it sort of opened that floodgate more than had been in the past.
Mm. I mean, because it's been happening since the beginning of movies that they're being adapted into musicals. But I do definitely think, you know, not that I have quantifiable research on this, but it seems like at some point there had to be something that just drove it up, because for a while there, that's, and maybe still, it's that and the jukebox musicals is really what we're seeing over and over
again. I do think producers is a large part of that influx in the last 20 years of movies turned to musicals. I remember I wasn't able to follow Broadway news as closely as you are now, growing up in Washington State in the early 2000s, 1990s. Mm-hmm. But I remember it was like a huge story in like national news when they brought Nathan Lane and Matthew Broderick back and they were going to make $100,000 a week. And it was just this big story. So they had great press people, first of all. But then secondly, you know, it was successful. So I think producers were like, interesting, let's see if we can capitalize on this. You know, I think they maybe sometimes misread the situation, and that it wasn't that it was a movie. It wasn't successful because it was a movie. And then we got a rush of, you know, popular movies turned into stage shows that can't really live up to what you were able to do on film.
Do you think, was there a different lesson that producers should have picked up on from the producers to say, if we want a surefire hit, this is what we should be taking from the producers?
I mean, yes and no. I think the lesson to take is, like, you should find lightning in a bottle. That's like the lesson. Okay, you should find an author and a director and a design team and six actors who like all can create magic together. You know, I do think a lot of it was that combination. But I think the lesson that many did pick up on was it's like the time to laugh. It's like the time to bring adults back to Broadway to enjoy musical comedy. You know, we'd sort of lost musical comedy for a while and got very serious when all the like London shows came in, and all the very serious Les Mis and Phantom and Miss Saigon and Cats and Show. Well, Cats isn't all that serious, but these big spectacle shows that it was more about like getting a ticket to be wowed by that rather than to go and just like laugh harder than you have all week. And so I think producers kind of gave that permission to like, it's okay to have an evening where you're just having like a great time. And maybe the message isn't huge and looming and like something you're going to carry with you for the rest of your life, but you are going to carry that sensation of just having a great time.
It is fascinating. One of our interviews is with Susan Stroman, our episode about Showboat. And Susan Stroman choreographed a revival of Showboat. And that's mostly what we're talking about. But we do talk about her work directing and choreographing The Producers. And it's just so evident. The minute it comes up as a subject, she says that Mel Brooks is one of her close friends. So I think when you say it's lightning in a bottle, it is just sort of everyone firing at 100% and making this near perfect comedy.
Yeah, I teach some directing classes, and I talk a lot about collaboration between directors and writers and designers. And I just think their collaboration is one of the best. I think it's one of the best in history. And it's partly because I think Mel Brooks was so smart in how he went about doing this. Like, he didn't want to write the score initially. He was talked into writing the score. He didn't approach it from a point of view of, I want to have like control over every aspect of this. So he knew he like wanted, so he found a music arranger who helped him arrange the music. He could have directed it himself, but he found someone who like really had musical comedy and musical theater in their blood and was like, let's do this together. And I just think that give and take between that creative team is so special. And I think most shows that I am attached to have that same sort of love, and you can't make it, you know, a producer can't put people together and force them to enjoy the process. So it happens sometimes. And I think it really comes out in the final product of this particular show.
Do you have other shows that you think like this have that lightning in a bottle quality to them that you would absolutely love to work on, to direct, to music direct, to conduct?
Yeah. Yes and no. I mean, I don't think I ever want to direct Hamilton, but I think Hamilton has the same situation with Tommy Cale and Lin-Manuel Miranda, two people who were like friends in college who have this relationship in the shorthand and are able to like, I mean, Lin-Manuel Miranda did so much for Hamilton, but to be able to stand back and like hand over some of the control to a person you trust is really special. So I think that creates just a final product that is so seamless, and you don't know where the writing began or the directing takes over, and you don't know like how much was the idea that was in the libretto and how much came up in the rehearsal room and with actors as well. You know, they had that big lawsuit that the actors ended up being compensated, which was great because we often undervalue the contributions actors make in a workshop that bring their ideas. And like, it's great when you can capitalize that and use everyone's idea in the room. Other shows that I like the original collaboration on. I mean, I think Hal Prince and Stephen Sondheim, like I think the shows they made together are pretty special. Yeah. And I think Lapine and Sondheim, when they worked, would work together, was pretty special as well. And you read like lots of things about the ups and downs in their relationships, but like obviously when they were working together, there was something very special happening. So I mean, I would direct any Sondheim show in a heartbeat. Like if you're a theater out there and you need someone, you hit me up. Just because they're always special. But I think their shows like Sweeney is such a special show that obviously was influenced by a director as well as the composer. You know, there, you can just feel the different strokes in there. You don't necessarily know whose idea was what, but you know that there was a give and take there and a trust between them.
It's that overlapping the Venn diagrams like you were talking about already, which is, I think those are some great examples, all the names that you gave, all those shows. Do you have anything that if a young person came to you and said, I'm going to be directing a production of The Producers, would you have anything that you would say to them would be like key, should be in the front of their mind at all times?
Yeah, I would say cast funny people. You know, it's musically, it's difficult, but there are plenty of people who've done the show who aren't the strongest singers. Ula is a hard one because there are some very specific voice stuff going on. But otherwise, like cast people who are funny and who make you laugh, because that is something that you can't teach in a rehearsal period of any length. Like you're not going to be able to find that. So do what you need to do in a rehearsal process if you don't know the actor, or an audition process, if you don't know the actors, to like find what they can do and what their comedy styles are. Because you also want people who are sort of on the same page. It's a it's a specific Borscht Belt kind of, there's lots of verbal wordplay as well as physical comedy. So, you know, you don't want to find one actor who's really funny with words, but can't like move their both their legs at the same time. You know, all of the characters are very physically demanding and very physically funny. You get to the end of that show and those actors are exhausted because it's not, it's very different than a lot of musical theater. It is very physically active. A lot of musical theater is, but it is very physically demanding in a way that some roles just aren't. So finding actors who can bring that to the table, I would test out, you know, test out vocally all six of your principles on the stuff, on the big stuff you really need to hear. I mean, that's kind of audition 101, but make sure that your Ula's got that belt at the end of that song, because if she doesn't, there's no point in that number. That whole number is about the end of that song, hitting that, I don't remember what the note is, but it's a high belt, E flat or D or something, making sure that they have that and that they have that while they're physical. So finding, I would find a way in auditions to marry physical with the vocal, because that's a big part of it. And then just using, once you've cast funny people, using their sense of sensibility and their sense of comedy. So like, it's one of those processes that I wouldn't come in having blocked it all out in advance. I would come in like with a sketch and like really ready to play with these actors so that you can find stuff that, use the stuff that's in the script, and then the other stuff that they sort of fill in, you can use their instincts, because that's always going to be funnier than you painting your comedy on them.
Right. Would you say, when you talk about this show being so physical, so exhausting, requiring, you know, wide range and Ula's voice, things like that, is this like, would you say that this is like a send up of Guys and Dolls, Hello Dolly, like older shows like that?
Yeah, I know the creative team have talked in the past about it being a love letter to classic musical theater. Okay. And if you look at like the original design is not as, it is innovative. It is not as visually innovative as designs were in like 2000. It was very much like, let's give an updated look to the shows of the 40s and 50s. Okay. So like the walls are, you know, kind of flat-ish and painted on posters of the shows, and the way the show moves is, it's beautiful. And it's not, I'd say it's old fashioned, but it's like old fashioned done brilliantly well. So you've got like a lot of drops and a lot of like pieces that come in because they wanted it to look and move like a 50s musical, but with a much more adult sort of sensibility to it.
And do you think that sort of this design that's harkening back to a different time, does that sort of keep the show looking timeless? Because I don't feel like it dates it.
Yeah, no, I totally think it does. I think you could look at photos of much of the producers and be like, is this 1947? Is this 1997? Is this 2037? Like, it just has a classic feel to it. And I mean, they like spruce things up. Like William Ivy Long did his signature sparkle tights where there's like diamond studs uh-huh. sewn into all the showgirls' tights so that they will glisten as they walk. And so it's like your love letter to the 1950s musicals just like kicked up a notch.
Would you say that you have any recommendations if there are listeners who maybe don't know the producers that well? What would you say is the best way to get into it? Should they see the movie, hear the soundtrack, see the original movie? Should they be reading it? What would you recommend?
I would recommend the original cast recording, like listen to the album. I think you get a lot of information off of that. And I would find the script and I would read the script.
Okay.
I don't think the original movie gives, it's good to reference, but it's tonally so different. I don't know that it gives that a director of the musical that much new information. And plus I like to go to like the source material when it's helpful, and I don't know that it's helpful here. And I don't think the movie, I wouldn't necessarily watch the movie adaptation only because it is a very faithful filming of the stage show, but the stage show works so well on stage and the film feels just a little bit 2D in a weird way. So if you can find a video of the original production and you want to watch that at Lincoln Center Library or wherever they show that sort of stuff, that can be helpful. But I think you can also just turn on your creative part of your imagination, and the libretto and the score and the cast recording will give you enough information to do it justice.
Great. Well, thank you so much for making the time to chat with me today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
And thank you, listeners, so much for joining us. Please make sure to purchase a copy of 50 Key Stage Musicals by visiting Routledge.com or by clicking in today's show description. If you want to learn more about the producers, please also review the links in the below description. I'm Andrew Child, and thank you for listening to 50 Key Stage Musicals, the podcast.
I wanna be a producer with a hit show on Broadway. I wanna be a producer, lunch at Sardi's every day. I wanna be a producer.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway, and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but yeah. Not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.